Do you love property like I do, but want to play the stock market? Isn't share trading just like gambling, Terry?
Not at all.
Then you need to listen to Terry Tran.
Don't be stupid and don't leverage yourself.
Yeah.
That's the first thing. Yeah, leverage kills you ultimately in the end.
From child refugee to veteran investor.
Just seeing my mum work so hard, my main thing was I wanted to, I guess, look after my mum.
He now teaches investors how to take the guesswork out of share trading.
For me, preservation of capital is number one, and then making money is number two.
It's all coming up in 10 with Ty.
Hi, I'm Tyrone Hyde, the CEO of Washington Brown, the property and depreciation expert. Now, I'm a qualified quantity surveyor and also a best-selling author who's helped hundreds of thousands of property investors over the years pay less tax through depreciation. I'm also an avid investor, which is why I created the podcast series, 10 with Ty, where I ask the smartest people I know the same 10 questions to unlock the keys to their success and hopefully leave a playbook for my family and your family too about investing. Now, this podcast is general in nature and not specific to your financial circumstances. We always recommend you sit down with an accountant or financial planner before making any investment decisions. Now, let's get on with the show. Hello and welcome to 10 with Ty. Today we're talking wealth creation with an inspiring individual who started life as a refugee from Vietnam. He watched his mother work two jobs and struggle financially to survive, then nearly worked himself to death in the corporate world before embarking on a path to financial freedom through share trading. He now helps others to do the same safely. Welcome to the show, Terry Tran.
Thanks, Tyron. Lovely to be here.
Thank you. It's great to have someone on the show who's starting to talk about shares, my second love, not just property for once.
That's good. That's good to hear.
Your father died when you were young and your mother was working two jobs. How did that shape your views in relation to work and wealth?
I think that changed me a lot because just seeing my mum work so hard, my main thing was I wanted to, I guess, look after my mum. And just seeing, even when I was a child, when she was doing the second job, even the first job, I was actually brought along because her first job was in a factory, a metals factory. And I'd be seeing her work. And at most times I would be hiding. There was a part of the female toilet that was actually far cooler because in summer especially it was very hot. So I would pretty much just do coloring books and play Lego in the female toilet and just waiting for her to come in and say hello. And then she'd take me home and then have a meal. And then literally we were off again on a train and then heading off to see her wash dishes in Parramatta in Sydney at an Indian restaurant. And then I'd be hanging around it. And back in the old days, I guess it was quite safe. I was running around the car park in the dark and just waiting for her for the next 3 or 4 hours.
Must be pretty proud of seeing what you're doing now.
She is. She saw me on stage once and seen a lot of the videos. And I think in a way, I don't think she totally understands what I totally do, but I think she does know that I help educate people.
Yeah.
So it did change me in terms of the financial sense where I wanted to make sure that I was able to look after her financially and get her off the two job thing and then down a track, be able to retire a bit earlier as well.
Fantastic. Very inspiring. Okay. Now let's talk shares. I've got to read you a quote. A blindfolded monkey throwing darts at a newspaper's financial pages could select a portfolio that would do just as well as one carefully selected by experts, said the American economist Burton McHale. Now, isn't share trading just like gambling, Terry?
Not at all. I mean, I've heard of that quote as well. I think a lot of the big fund managers, they can't even beat the so-called index, and that is actually a true fact. But however, I believe that a carefully chosen share portfolio, whether you're trading or investing, will do far better. And in a way, when you do it that way, it's not like gambling. For me, just like property, you could buy any property on the street, but if you overpay for it, you're also likely to lose money, if you're also just trusting tips from family and friends and you're not also doing the research properly on property itself, there's no difference between shares as well. You do need to do the research, make sure you do also know what you're buying, most importantly, and paying at the right price as well. So the two asset classes, which I personally, people think I'm a share trader or share investor and I don't like property, I do believe in a well-diversified portfolio. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I do believe that if you put in a bit of the effort, you can definitely get far higher returns than a so-called blind monkey.
Well, it's funny that you talk about the amount of times that the active fund managers don't beat the index, right? That's actually I found that quote because I Googled one of the percentages, right? And it came up with this quote, funnily enough.
And actually, Tyrone, I want to add that the reason why individuals can potentially outperform the most of the fund managers is because those guys, they've got a big disadvantage is because they are way bigger. Really, it's their size. They're not as nimble. So for them to get in and out of a position, they're having to sell $50, $100 million, either get in or get out. They've got a very sizable position and they literally move the markets. Whereas for us as individuals, we're far more nimble because of our size. We can get in and get out far more quickly as well.
Does that then enable your investors to get into more illiquid stocks rather than the big fund managers, thus being able to get to trade when they want to trade rather than having to do the $50 million plus trades?
That's definitely a true statement for sure. But however, even for myself, for me, I'm all about risk management. So even for myself, I generally don't like illiquid stocks. I tend to go to the bigger end of town where the big fund managers are because money can still be made there, but be done in much safer way as well. So the likes of Apple, Microsoft, I actually like those type of stocks. So I'd still go there. Whereas I really, because of the risk management, I really avoid those illiquid type stocks as well.
Tell me about Freedom Trader. Are you giving people the tools to work out which stocks to buy? Or are you telling them which stocks to buy?
No, I want to, my first and foremost is actually educate. So for me, I actually want to educate them, but I also show them where I guess there's a lot of free tools out there as well. And those tools I personally use, I just want to share with them where you can get those tools. And at the same time, I've also built tools that I provide them to be used as well. And we do also show not primarily recommend them what to buy or sell, because I do believe that action speaks louder than the word. So what I do is I actually share with them what I'm doing myself, because I think that just gives people a lot more confidence to show them where I'm putting my own family's wealth as well. So I'm literally sometimes buying at the same time and in the same stocks with them as well.
Right, right. And are they watching you, what you buy?
Yes, they am. So besides, I think it gives them confidence, because even though I teach a lot, people, it's because they're new to the game. So they're still quite nervous, even though I've taught them what to do and the tools to use. But by them then, you know, finding their own stocks or their own investments and then seeing it on, say, reports that I'm also buying those stocks or selling those stocks, and it matches what they've also found, it just then gives them that confidence to therefore click on the button. So I don't want them to ever just blindly copy what Terry does, because that's the last thing I want them to do, but to be educated in their own decision-making. And by doing so, it just gives them a lot more confidence to scale as well, because you can start off small, but as you scale over time, it's far more important to know what you are doing, being in control, and therefore having that confidence to scale up your portfolio beyond six figures and eventually over seven figures as well.
I like that they can see what you're doing. I don't know if you remember Rene Rivkin.
Yes, I do.
And the Rivkin report, and he was recommending people to buy these stocks, but previously he'd already bought these penny stocks. He then put out a recommendation that, hey, you should buy this stock, and he was the one selling. And then what they had to do that to change the disclaimers on everyone that was giving stock tips, that you had to disclose what your actual stocks that you held at the time of giving a tip. So it's good that you're giving that information out.
We even give that in advance, saying that, guys, I'm getting ready to buy this stock, so make sure you check this out. And we are going to be buying at the same time, because I've taught them the tools to use to see when to actually get in. And I'll be getting in the same day as them as well. So literally, we are getting in at the same time. And when we get out, I also give them an advance notice that, guys, it's overvalued, or it's time to actually get out. I'm not comfortable with this. And in time, based on the information that we've got, we'll be getting in out at the same time as well.
Fair enough. All right, one final question before we get into 10 with Ty. What are the three biggest mistakes you see traders make?
One, following the hype, following the trend of what's hot in the market. Two is blindly just copying what people do as well, taking a tip from a family or friend or even at a barbecue. And then thirdly is taking on board leverage, in fact. So as you know, leverage is a double-edged short sword, both in stocks but also property. But with stock leverage, far more dangerous, because there's a thing called margin calls. With margin lending, and even with things like derivatives like CFDs, at any point in time you get margin called, unlike property, which is, you know, the banks are unlikely to give you a margin call. So that just doesn't happen. So a lot of people take on board the leverage thinking that everything's going well, but then when things change, they get caught up with too much leverage as well.
Happened twice to me, once in the tech crash and the giant C. I had too much gearing and it snowballed. And literally, I had to put in a shitload of money or sell stocks. And I chose, luckily, to sell the stocks. It pretty much wiped out my share portfolios twice. But yes, I'm glad I did that rather than having to get equity from my house or from my business. I just decided, no, I can't do that. So that's when I wish I learned more about stop losses back then. I didn't really have much of it. But maybe we'll talk about that when it comes to your worst investments and how we can limit those worst investments. We talk about stop losses.
Yes.
All right, let's play Tell With Ty. Are you ready? I've got a button here I'm going to press,
yep,
Terry, before we get started.
No worries.
It happens every time. That's good.
That sounds like
makes, makes me laugh every time. All right, Terry, what has been your best investment?
I would say informal education. So I know we all get educated in Australia. We've got great education system. But however, there's nothing about finance and investing and how to make a financially free life afterwards. So definitely a lot of informal education. Some good, some bad. But overall, just that education on across all boards, whether I actually started off with more on mindset side. So yeah, the likes of Tony Robbins, things like that. I actually went into that when I was quite young at 17, 18.
Yep.
So that was my first, foray into education, informal education. And then afterwards, every program that was under the sun, literally, I just went to those investment, whether for property as well as stocks as well. I did them all. And I think I would consider that as the best education ever, because you learn about all the different asset classes and knowing what to do going forward as well.
Yep. It's been an overwhelming theme, investing in yourself and knowledge has been one of the overwhelming themes when that comes to that answer. But what has been one stock that you've been, God, I got that one right?
It would be actually Apple.
Apple? Okay.
Yeah, it would be Apple, because the fundamentals, when Jobs came back in, the fundamentals were great. But then when Warren Buffett initiated his very first purchase, we could see that. And when knowing Warren Buffett, he's not a trader. He's a long-term value investor. So he could see value in Apple. And then that made me very confident that he's seeing something that I'm seeing, undervaluation. And then over time, knowing that he was going to accumulate as well, and I was accumulating at the same time with him.
Yeah. I saw that too. And I wish I kicked myself that I didn't. I've actually kicked myself more when I was actually at a pub and a guy said to me, who worked for a telecommunications company, said, and Apple had just relaunched their phone and Steve Jobs done it. He said, and it was like, 20, it was ridiculously low. And he said, you should buy this. This is your phone. It's really good. I wish I did. Anyway, question number two, Terry, what has been your worst investment?
I've actually had so many.
I can't choose your best one.
I have had a lot as well. I don't call them as mistakes, because you learn from them. And that's what I try to teach our members, to not do what I've done as well. So there's many mistakes, so to speak. We usually get 8 to 9 out of 10 investments right. So that's not the issue, but it's more of what I did structurally. So back in the old days, I was writing, I believed in all that get rich quick as a young guy. Writing options, I think would be with leverage, was probably one of the worst. And I was probably seduced into the fact that I was getting very good and getting good returns of that 1 to 3% per month. And I was getting month in, month out. And I did that for a whole 2 years. So you can imagine, 2 or 3%, 20-odd, 30% return income year in, year out. And it happened actually for a whole 2 years. But then when the market turned, it just wiped the entire 2 years of profit out, plus more. And at that time, it was $250,000 overnight, literally in 1 hour. And that I would say is the worst, in so-called investment as a young 21, 22-year-old ever.
Right. How do you teach your members to limit their loss? Do they use, are you teaching them a stop-loss strategy or a trailing stop-loss strategy?
Yeah. So first and foremost, whether you're investing or trading, our first thing is that to understand what the world is and where it's going through at this point in time. So we understand the macro side. So that limits the world blowing up, so to speak. So when, for example, GFCs, coronaviruses, those type of crashes happen, they don't happen overnight. There's always data showing up that says there's a problem brewing. So when we see that, we actually are very cautious. So we start actually liquidating to make sure that we get have a lot of cash back in our accounts.
But how do you see that?
Oh, there are actually a lot of free tools out there that you can see the liquidity of banks, the liquidity of the financial system, and also the fear and greed of what the public actually is at this point in time. So there's actually quite a few. There's 6 tools in total. So they're actually there. So I just show the members, what they are, but also how to read them. So that's one. The other thing too is fundamentally an analysis of whether you get into a stock short term or long term. It is important that you know what you're buying into. So they're not companies that you, even though you're trading, you're buying to them, all of a sudden you hear bad news that they're going to go bankrupt the next day. So fundamentally, those stocks need to be also very strong at the same time. And then finally, the other thing too is, you know, you talked about stop losses. If they are trades, to also have stop losses in place as well. So have a basically a percentage level where, you know, yeah, things have gone wrong according to where it should be, and therefore it just automatically liquidates you, that position anyway.
It's just two things. So firstly, is it a case then of sometimes it's better to do nothing, get out of the market and sit out and wait because the risk is higher than being in the market?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So for example, I'll just give an example of real life case studies. GFC, we saw the market back then. I was still managing funds, and we saw the market three and a half months. There were signs that there was something wrong. I didn't know what was happening, but we could see that the markets at the tools were breaking, and it wasn't just one tool breaking. It was actually one by one. They were all ducks lined up. They were just breaking one by one, and we could see that something was wrong. And I'm not just to say that I could predict that there'll be a market crash. I can't do that. No one can. If someone says that, they're BSing. But however, we could see things breaking. So I was actually quite early, too early, in fact, that I started getting out and liquidating a lot of our overvalued positions. And by the end of it, by the time it actually happened, we had about 80% cash, still 20% of, I didn't liquidate everything, but 20% of the portfolio was still invested with undervalued stocks. We kept that. So that was one. And then the other one was, for example, even Corona, we could see things breaking. It was telling us that the system was breaking. Liquidity of banks were drying up. Again, I didn't know that it was going to be coronavirus, but we could see things happening. And that one was a little bit shorter, about 2 months. So we were, again, early. But when it happened, this time I was now teaching. So not only myself, but as a whole group, hundreds of students, we were actually quite happy that the market crashed because it went down by about 30%+. And we had all this cash ready to deploy again and buying undervalued assets.
When only markets crash for an external source that no one sees, it's when it's in the papers that, this is coming. It doesn't generally occur. Like the mortgage cliff at the moment doesn't seem to have had a major effect on the property market, right?
Right. Now, I think sometimes for us, I just see headlines as already either too late.
Yep.
So they're just headlines that they make the news. But for me, I would rather have data let us know what is really happening behind the scenes rather than the actual headlines itself. The headlines is great for one reason, is that just to see the psychology of where the market actually is, or whether it's property market or the stock market, because ultimately in the end, it's still the wealth effect. So just seeing the psychology of the general public to know where they're at. But in terms of to take action, we use data rather than just the headlines itself.
I think I should briefly explain to people what a stop loss is. So for instance, if you buy $100 worth of stocks, you can tell the broker that if it goes down 15%, an automatic trade kicks in and sells it at $85. You can also have a trailing stop loss that if you say, okay, I still want the 15% difference to go up, but say that stock goes to $200, it would need to come back down 15% from the $200 to kick in. That's right, Terry?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. And one thing that is important if you do stop losses is to be hidden from the market, because if you just do a simple stop loss out there, the entire market can actually see you. So what we would rather do is what they call a conditional stop loss. So therefore, the order's hidden until a certain condition is met. And then the market, it literally comes in and then the stop loss is taken out. So nobody has seen the order literally until that point in time.
Didn't know that. Learned something today. Good. Great. I've probably learned a lot today. One, do you have a recommendation of a stop loss percentage, or is it depending upon the stock?
Sure. For me, I've just gone back in data. Again, I'm very data-driven. So I looked back in time of all my history of 25-plus years and where have the biggest mistakes have occurred. And I've just found that roughly between that 7 to 8% mark as a stop loss, that knowing that that's a mistake and that's it. Yeah. And then does it sometimes what they call like gapping, which means that the stock, even though you've put a stop loss at a certain percent, you know, a certain price, then some bad news earnings announcement, it actually gaps below that. So that also can happen. So I just want to make sure that people do understand that even though you put a stop loss, it's not guaranteed that you're going to get it at that price. If it gaps down with a big gap, as in the price just, you know, the market opens and the price goes below your stop loss, it will execute, of course, at that price.
Yep.
So that 7-8% will be breached, but that's very rare. It's generally that 7-8% because it slowly goes down.
I guess I can go both ways. If you're shorting and you have and then a company gets taken over overnight after market and opens up,
yes,
you're can be in a bit of trouble there.
Yeah, correct. And since you've mentioned shorting too, Tyron, I didn't want to mention earlier because I didn't want to confuse the audience, but during the GFC, we actually shorted because, you know, I said that there was still 20% of the portfolio still in the market. So what we did was we actually shorted the market to that 20% level. So ultimately, in the end, during GFC and during COVID, while the market was obviously down, our 20% portfolio that we still held was dropping as well. But however, we had the shorter positions that allowed us to therefore hedge ourselves. So ultimately, in the end, we lost no money. It was actually neutral, even though we still had a 20% portfolio.
Do you want to briefly explain shorting?
Sure. When you go, what they call go long, your bank's basically thinking that the stock is going to go upwards. So you buy low and you sell high. Shorting is basically the reversal, almost like a mirror image. So now what you're doing is if you believe that either the market or the stock is going to go down, you sell high and then you buy back low to close that position. So it's just a total opposite position compared to the normal stock buying.
Yep. Cool. All right. Thanks for that. That was one of the best answers to the worst investment because I think we actually learned a bit as well.
Do you own an investment property? Washington Brown has helped over 250,000 property investors pay less tax with a depreciation schedule. Visit washingtonbrown.com.au to pay less tax today.
Question number three. What's been the most valuable investment advice you've ever received, Terry?
I think, importantly, that you get educated by someone who's actually done it, not someone who's just out there peddling their course and has actually never done it and probably watched a few YouTube videos and decided that now they're an expert and I'll put up a course and sell it for thousands. So for me, my education was after I had all those losses at the beginning when I was young, 19 to 21, that was a very bad experience. I realized I actually knew nothing. So I went back to the Oracle at Omaha, read through his Berkshire Hathaway, the letters, and just realized, wow, now this is the way to go, value investing. And then by also being out there and contacting as many fund managers, super fund guys that were running big funds. And of course, these guys do know what they're doing because they're running our super industry, for example, retirement funds. And then did I get a lot of rejections? Definitely. I did get quite a few rejections that, no, waste of time. But there were quite a few that saw the enthusiasm. So they had coffees and lunches with me over time. And then that's how I learned what they were doing as well. So I was learning literally from the people who manage people's money. So I think it's important that you get knowledge and education from people who have actually done it.
I agree. I don't know exactly what it's like in your industry, but in the property industry, it's the amount of people that have bought one or two properties and then become property experts is quite yes. astounding in my Facebook feed, let me tell you.
Yeah, and I think it's the same thing with a few people who hit it on, say, AI stocks and they make a bundle, right. Just purely the right timing, and all of a sudden they just become an overnight expert as well.
Yeah. Great. All right, number four, what's your ideal portfolio mix? I know you're not into Bitcoin because I saw you on a YouTube channel say you don't do Bitcoin, but what's your ideal portfolio mix?
I think this is going to be different to everyone depending on your risk tolerance and also your age as well. Yeah. So I'm in my late 40s now. So for me, I've still got a lot of time until retirement and I just go for the growth side. So therefore for me, it's 80% more towards 7 to 80% stocks and then the other 20 to 30% on the property side. The reason why I like stocks more is because it's liquid, it's unleveraged and yeah, in terms of what you're making. And then the other side, which I still like as well, the property is because of obviously the banks giving you that leverage as well. And it is very much safer leverage compared to stocks. So having sort of both of them, but more towards which is where I'm strong at anyway, towards the stock side, having that grow without leverage, basically return on assets, return on equity is the same thing because of without the leverage side. But then the property side, you're getting that extra leverage side. So you're getting a higher return on the ROE, basically, return on equity.
But within your stock portfolio, for me, I have about 40% of my stock portfolio in banks because they never lose money, about 40% in mid caps, and I generally like ones that pay dividends. You know, some of the shareholders are buying and buybacks are on. So I kind of like those kind of stocks. I find them. And then I have about 20% in a mixture of REITs, real estate investment trusts, and about in that 20%, about 10% REITs and 10 of play things, I call them, or the fund stocks, right? Low caps. What about you? In your portfolio of stocks, do you have a market weight of each?
So this will be a surprise to a lot of people. I don't, simply because I'm like the fund managers. I'm not I'm not, there's no, I guess, rule book that I need to follow. So for me, I just see what I do is I generally try to have 50% over time, growing a 50% long-term portfolio, and also a 50% shorter-term / income type portfolio. What that means is on the longer-term portfolio and both short-term portfolio, there's no percentage-wise where I say, oh, I need to have this such and such in, you know, real estate investment trusts, such and such in banks, such and such in technology stocks. I don't have that. The reason being is that I allow the market to give me the opportunities. So when the market is on sale, I see what industry and what stocks are on the most sale. And if they're on the most sale, they are also the lowest risk. So we'll slowly add positions there. And it naturally just diversifies, but also naturally lets your portfolio, I guess, in terms of percentage-wise, diversify to whatever percentage it actually is based on what's on sale at that point in time. So if that makes sense.
Yeah. So you're, I guess, a bit more of an active trader. Are there any stocks that you've held for like 10 years or constantly rolling over?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So 50% of the portfolio is definitely more longer term. So they're not active traders. They're more where I'm going to be buying them and holding them for a long time. Because I always say that there are some stocks that should be held long term. And there are also stocks that should never be held long term. And the ones that are held long term, generally, they've got a global presence. The likes of the Googles of the world, the Apples of the world, they've just got a global audience that they serve 8 billion people. Whereas even though I live in Australia, I generally more trade our Australian stocks. I love our banks, not because of the dividends. I love trading them twice a year. And I trade like the likes of Telstra. Don't like their financials because ultimately in these companies, their profitability is capped. Their so-called blue chip just means that they're big, but they don't necessarily mean that they're very extremely, they are profitable, don't get me wrong, but their portfolio, their profit margins and profitability is always capped to that 26, 27 million people. With migration coming through. So I'd like to trade them a couple of times a year because they just always, it's like a wave that come down, undervalued, I buy them, overvalued, I sell them, undervalued, and then I just take that money and I go somewhere else. On the long-term side though, generally they're global companies and I know that they've got this global audience. They finish, for example, like Apple, done with China, now they're moving their factories and also their new clientele into India. So that's another 1.5 billion people to serve. So therefore, they're the longer term investments because I know over time their profitability will keep on going up and up and up.
Someone told me once, just buy four stocks, big, rather large stocks, and just trade them for the rest of your life.
Again, Tyra, that's why I generally go into the large cap because to trade them, way safer, but also much more liquid. So there's no need to go into the spec side, the mining stocks, stuff like that. For me, preservation of capital is number one. And then making money is number two.
Interesting. What about charting? How do you get charting involved or do you at all
Initiative? I actually don't do charting at all. So all these trend lines, and I used to be a day trader using charts. So I learned all that. I spent probably at least $50,000 learning charting. But I did it for about a year. And then I realized that I made money. I lost money. At the end of sort of 18 months, I made no money. So through ego, I was a day trader. But in the end, did it make a difference in my life? No, it didn't. It got me excited and spent a lot of time staring at the screen. So what we do is, though, what they call technical analysis is actually quite simple. Mm. If you just boil it down to two things. Stocks are just like commodities and property, for that matter. They're determined by the prices, determined by supply and demand. And with stocks, very different. Unlike property, it's the demand and supply is actually ultimately in the end, not you or I. We are very tiny players in the market. The ones who control the supply and demand are the institutions, the big fund managers, super funds, pension funds. So when these guys are buying, creates demand, pushes prices up. When they're selling, 50, 100 million at a time, they push prices down. And because we're value investors, we also invest very similar to them, finding the right stocks. And if we like the stock that they like, we wait till they buy and we buy with them. And if we are trading it and we see them start selling in a big scale, we sell with them because the price will also drop over time because these guys are selling hundreds of millions at a time as well. Mm-hmm. So if you boil it down, charting is just a couple of, I guess, volume type tools that just see the volume of these guys coming in and they're not mums and dads volume. They're volume from the institutions. And that's it, literally.
The only thing I like about incorporating a little bit of charting into my trading is that charts don't lie. People do.
Yes. Yeah, correct. Yeah, so there is that charting, but it's more on the indicator side. So we look at the stock charts, but we look at more on the indicator side of seeing fund managers come in and go out. And then that just gives you far more accuracy because, you know, the thing, I don't know if you've drawn trend lines before, you know, which for charting, when you're optimistic, sometimes both you and I can, you know, we go through the same course and sometimes we're literally drawing even trend lines at the same different angles, for example, and we see different things.
Yep.
So it's very subjective. So I'd rather have something that's very black and white, nothing gray, where you go, oh, should I, shouldn't I? It's either yes or no. So I prefer that. So what that means is that then you become an unemotional investor and trader in the long run. Yeah, and that's the thing that I think trips people up is that psychology bit that they don't have.
Excellent. All right, number five, Terry.
Yes.
How would you invest $20,000 as a 20-year-old? If you were 20 today and you saved up and had 20 grand, how would you invest it today?
I actually could diversify with a cheap wholesale broker. So I would actually start trading rather than long-term investing because long-term investing without leverage does take a long time. So when you start trading that properly, you know, and being able to achieve that sort of 10, 15, 25, 20, 25% per annum and doing it in a safe manner, then that would pretty much every couple of years, it would double your money. So therefore that compounding effect. And then once you get to above 50 to 100,000, that's when you can introduce, I guess, the long-term investing into that portfolio as well.
I like that. Do you have many 20-year-olds in your group or is it all middle-aged people? Or
well, I do have a lot of teenagers. It's only because they're children of my members.
Right.
And they've learned it from their parents. So we do have teenagers as well. And one actually left me a review and also a comment last, I think, 2 months ago. I mean, the market did, I think, 7-8%, but she had year-to-date 36% return. So she actually commented that, which is incredible for her. She's 19 now. She started when she was 17. But in the public side, generally the young 20-year-olds don't get attracted to me because I'm so-called too slow and uncool. They like crypto. They like 50. And I've actually been on stage and someone came down and they asked me, you know, what's expected return? I said, oh, generally that 15 to 20% mark is where I'm comfortable at. And they just go, oh, why are you so slow? Someone else down the road promised me 50%. I said, I don't like risk. That. Yeah, so they ended up not coming over to me. They ended up going to them. So I think what ends up happening is that a lot of the young ones need to burn themselves, get that lesson. Then over time, in their 30s, they end up coming back over time.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah.
All right, question number six, the flip side.
Yes.
There's got to be a massive transfer of wealth soon from the baby boomers to the 50-year-old. So
yes.
If you were 50 years old, had no money, and just inherited 500 grand, how would you invest it?
If I was 50, firstly, it depends if I already own my own home.
Yeah, so you've got no money. You've got no money.
I've got no money. Okay. No. So I would, if I could, I would take that money and time it, of course, you know, see what's an undervalued property and have that as a home. I would buy that first. If I didn't have, had no money and had no home, I would do that first and get myself off the rent cycle. And obviously something that's affordable and not over leveraged where you sort of kill yourself with mortgage as well. And then have that as at least I've established my home. And then once I have that established affordable, then I'll use debt recycle and then use some of the leverage over time to therefore leverage over into the stock side as well. So then you get the best of both worlds.
Interesting, the share experts are telling people to buy property, which I that's a bit of independence there is great.
Yeah.
They're fantastic. All right, number seven, Terry.
Yes.
If you could fly back in time, getting the TARDIS, and you could see your 20-year-old self, what would you tell your 20-year-old self about investing that you've learned over, 25 years of investing now, I think I saw somewhere?
Yeah. Don't be stupid and don't leverage yourself.
Yeah.
And that's the first thing. Yeah, leverage kills you ultimately in the end. So I would say, you know, don't ever think about margin. I've done leverage when I was 19 because I believed in the get rich quick and did the CFDs, leveraged 20, 30 times. Did the Forex trading leverage as well, did the options trading leverage, did margin lending with stocks also leverage, and that ultimately burned the hole. So I would say be unleveraged with stocks. And if you do want to leverage, then do it with the property equity instead. That's far safer because I would say that when you're 20, you've got enough time, compounding time. There's no need to rush. Have that patience and build wealth the proper way. Because by the time, if you do it properly and without leverage and just do it safely, by the time you're 30, you'd actually be, you do very well,
without that. I tried CFDs. You want to explain, CFD is a contract for difference. I'll let you explain it in a second, but I had a go at it for about a month and I saw how much leverage you could get and I ran. It's just scary, right?
Yeah. But people think that when you buy CFDs, you own the share. You don't. It's what they call a derivative. So it's the price is derived from a share, but it's just a synthetic contract that is priced to a share. But the thing is that they give you a lot of leverage and depending on which provider, some in the old days, they used to give you 10 to 20 times, but then these days, I believe they go up to 50 times as well. And what that means, though, is let's say you had $100,000, and they gave you $50,000 leverage. So what that means is you literally only need $2,000 to have $100,000 leverage or $100,000 portfolio. And for the portfolio to drop 2%, which means that your $2,000 from $100 down to $98,000, you've lost your $2,000. So you're wiped out pretty much. So that's what CFD, the power of CFD and leverage actually can do. But of course, on the flip side, if things do go well, you'll do well from your little tiny $2,000 account. But then generally in the stock market, yeah, you don't want to take that risk as well.
I just thought it just was like highly leveraged gambling to me.
Yes, it is. Very highly leveraged. And I think people, when I see advertisements, they show what's possible of the upside, but they never show you people on the streets without a home on the down. So there's never advertisements about that, which a lot of people actually suffer from that, but it's never seen. It's always in the background.
Ken with Ty is brought to you by Washington Brown, the property depreciation expert.
Right, question number 8, Terry. What legacy do I leave your family or your community?
I think firstly, I want to be known as a great son to my mum, a great brother to my siblings, and also a great, friend to my friends and family, and also a great mentor to people who actually want to learn this properly. So that's first and foremost. Being able to, whoever wants to learn, being able to go out there and just help as many business owners and in particular farmers as well, create that off-business wealth so they don't rely on that volatile earnings of their business. If things go bad, i.e. coronavirus, they've got another off-business portfolio that supports them during volatile times and being able to survive and thrive during both good and bad times. Yeah, so that's what I want to be able to help people do, and hopefully that becomes sort of my legacy and showing what can go wrong but more importantly, what can be made with enough time as well in terms of portfolios.
That's great. I saw on your YouTube channel there were a lot of farmers. How did that come about? Farmers in your course?
I'm actually, funny enough, now I've become the biggest farming educator in the country now.
Really?
Stop. Yeah, literally. We've got over 400 Aussie farming families with us now across the land.
Wow.
And it started with one. And this was going back 6 years ago when I was introduced to a farmer, and I actually wasn't sure whether I could help the farmer because the numbers, but farmers are actually very, they're obviously to run a farm properly and survive, they are very smart people. So it's just that they've never been introduced or had that education. So that one farmer, I would also say farmers, because of that one farmer, I could see how farmers could become very good stock investors. And they actually are, because they're so used to that, they've got patience because they're so used to that sort of the seeding and then the harvesting cycle. So they're willing to wait that sort of the cycle, which is like the stock market as well. So they've got that patience. And when things don't go always 100% right, they're also very persistent. So then that one farmer did very well. I believe he did his first year, he did about 15, just over 15%. And then I was invited to a farming conference association. And he was there. So I asked him, would you mind going up on stage with me and sharing your portfolio on the big screen, on the Excel spreadsheet? And literally we put up on the big screen and we just went through his journey. And that there was about almost 100 farmers in the room. And then they saw that in them. And it was from there that the whole thing started. And then over time, word of mouth became what it is today.
Have they got enough time to trade, or are they up so early then they've got all day to trade?
What I teach, it's a systemized process where it actually doesn't take long. And we've got a lot of interviews actually showing you how farmers only, on average, it depends on the market, usually on average between 15, 20 to 30 minutes a day.
Right.
So yes, they do have time, provided they make that time. And it really, everybody's got that if they really want it. So it's not staring, unlike the day trading, you're staring at the screen. You're not. When you're systemized and you're process driven with like a checklist, you're literally just following a checklist. And then if it's great, you take it. If it's great, if it's not good, or the market's not the right timing, you switch off the PC and just enjoy life or enjoy life on the farm. There's no point in trying to stare at the screen and trying to find something because there's no low hanging fruit. So we go for low hanging fruit instead. Yeah. And if there's no low hanging fruit, we just, enjoy life, literally.
And are they trading Aussie stocks or NASDAQ, or what is the majority of your
Both. So I would say 80 to 90% of our investing is in the US market because all the global companies are there. The liquidity is there. The S&P, of course, 500, Fortune are there as well. The Aussie stocks, like I said, a lot of them are not for long-term investments, more on the trading side. So when the opportunities do happen, we do trade and invest in the Aussie market as well. But one good thing about the US market is people go, don't you have to wake up on, stay at night, late at night type thing. But the US market is, in fact, because we put our orders at the end of the market because the liquidity is there. The most liquidity, the reason why is that the fund managers, whether they're trading their portfolios or investing in the portfolio, they generally don't like overnight risk. So they close out their portfolio at the end of the day. So generally when the New York Stock Exchange closes at pretty much 4 p.m. their time, it's also early in the morning our time. At the moment, I'm in Sydney, so it's 8 a.m. So a lot of times we just put our order in the last 15 minutes of the day, put our orders, and then that's it. Because we know, we do our research off market. We know what we want to buy or sell. And all we are doing in the market is literally checking the final indicator. Fund managers, are they coming in or getting out? For example, if we aren't buying, we just want to see the fund managers coming in. And if they are, we take on that order, takes about a minute, and then that's it.
Are you talking about that? Like,
very much.
Are you talking about that 30-minute window after the market closes where you
No.
Trade,
30 minutes before, 15 to 30 minutes before the market actually closes beforehand.
Right. Yeah, right.
And could you do it after market? Yes, you could put limit orders with outside market hours. If you miss the market, you could do that as well. And generally, 90% of the time, you actually get that order taken as well.
Cool. All right. Now, you've had an interesting upbringing.
Yes.
But what does success look like to you? You look pretty successful now. What does success look like to you, Terry?
I think for me, it's obviously having love in your life, you know, having people care about you, you caring about people. So that's one thing. The other thing too is, definitely health, because I want to stay healthy, because as we get older, people forget that health is pretty much what they have. You can have all this money, but if there's no health, there's no point. The other thing too is what I call total freedom, where money, free from finances, not having to worry about, the bills coming through. So having that freedom for money, monetary, but also freedom for time, being able to be wherever you are around the world, being able to do whatever you want with whoever you want. So you can choose, be in control. And then the third one is experiences. Like, I love travel. You'll see me running around the world, all different countries, experiencing the cultures and doing adventurous things. And that's just me. So I think those three, money, time, experiences. And if you have all three plus health and family, then that's for me a very successful life. And of course, everybody's different. I think everybody will rank, depending on where they are in life, different things on different scales. But I think if you have those sort of three to five things, your life is pretty successful.
I guess the freedom trader is one of the best things about trading is the freedom, right?
Yes. And you'll be surprised at where wireless connection is available. I mean, I was going on overnight trading through Vietnam. I was touring through Vietnam, my home country. And I thought that there was no way there's going to be wireless communication here because I needed to buy one of the pharmaceutical stocks.
Right.
And literally logged on, wow, their wireless was actually way faster. It was global roaming with Telstra, but it was way faster than even Australia, the best Telstra connection I can get at home. So they were about 200 to 250 download speed, megabytes per second.
Fantastic.
Which is incredible on an overnight train. And I could actually put on my order and then enjoy the day.
Cool. So question number 10 is a good one for you. Warren, you'll know this. Warren Buffett's rule number one is never to lose money. And rule number two, never forget rule number one. How do we, as an investor, not lose money, Terry?
I actually would like to add another quote on top of, which is also Buffett's quote as well, which is, price is what you pay, value is what you get. So a lot of people just don't understand that they think price and value are the same. So they just go in there and they just buy something. So to not lose money, the biggest, safest way is, in fact, knowing what you're buying. Fundamentally, is the stock sound, even if it's a property? Is the property sound structurally in the right area, etc.? So you need to know what you're buying. And then secondly, paying the right price. So if you don't know what you're paying for and all of a sudden there's a hype, let's say I always compare it to property, where you see it all the time. There's auctions and the house clearly is worth, say, $1 million. But because of emotion, they end up paying, say, overbidding and paying, say, $1.5 million. They've overpaid for quite a fair sum. So yes, they'll probably make money, but it's going to take them time down a track to eventually for the property to catch up that price. Stocks is no different. If you overpay for it, you could make money, but you're risking that now. The downside is there that it comes back to what it's actually valued at. So you've got now risk as well. So you need to know what you're buying and pay the right price. And if you're patient enough to do that, then you'll do quite well over time.
But with stocks, every day, in essence, it's an auction for that
yes.
stock price, right?
Yes.
So isn't every day, isn't that a market value or every day of that stock?
No, it's the market price, but not the market value. because the market value is based on what its earnings are and what its assets are. So that's why I show our members how to actually fundamentally evaluate a stock and value the stock. So fundamentally, it needs to be strong. It's making profits. Its return on equity is right. Its return on assets right. It's making good money, net profit margins. So all those numbers need the 10 criteria that I talk about, they are important. So that's fundamentally a great stock. But then now, is the price cheap enough? Even though if we like the stock, if it's not at the right price, we still don't want to buy it. We'll hold back until it eventually drops that price, because it actually does over time.
How can a mum and dad investor value a stock better than, say, an active fund manager?
Active fund managers, what they do is there's two models. What active fund managers, and I don't want to get into too much detail because it will confuse people, but a lot of people do, that they use what they call the discounted cash flow model. And if you look at the formula, it's very based on a lot of guesswork of not what the earnings have been, but what the earnings of a company is going to be, the cash flows basically over time. And no, really, in the end, nobody, they'll have a good idea of the part based on the past, but really nobody has a crystal ball to say, oh, in 5 years' time, this company's going to earn this amount. And that's why the fund managers and analysts that do this full time, they're always guessing about what the earnings are. And I don't like using that model because that guessing is always wrong. So I use another model, which is based on really what's the path, what has it done. It's a much more conservative model, so you will miss out on some investments and trades, but I would prefer to go on the lower risk side and use that model to do the valuation without the guesswork as well. So that's why we generally are far more cautious. Not to say that we are smarter than them, by far we are not. But however, they also get it wrong, because in the end, they're also human.
Well, there's one thing I didn't tell you, Terry. There is a surprise question that I ask for every guest, and it's relevant to their expertise. And funnily enough, yours is about shares. So the 10-year horizon, what would be one theme you'd want to you'd invest in? Whether, because there's so many different ETFs now, you can buy ones relevant to health and AI and electric vehicles, etc. I'm not going to ask you for one specific stock, but one theme that you can see being a good investment over the next 10 years.
I would probably say another one just came up to me. I think there's two themes. One is definitely, everybody's been hearing it now, AI, artificial intelligence, the revolution. And I think it's going to be a game changer. And there are a lot of company stocks that do deal with that industry, but not all of them are equal. So there's a lot of semiconductor companies coming into that sector, prioritizing the chips that make that go into that industry, etc. Of course, the electric vehicles, etc. as well. So all that is going towards there. But however, still the underlying theme, no matter what, is yes, that's a great theme and trend, but in the end, you still need to pay the right price because you can go into that sector, but if you overpay for it, you're putting on board an extra risk that you shouldn't have. But if you pay the right price, and there are plenty of stocks that are part of that AI revolution, but they are not valued correctly yet. So they'll get there, but they are actually undervalued. So you're actually better off buying those companies first. They probably won't have explosive growth as some of the others that already have, but the risk is far lower as well. So that's one thing. The other thing that I'm seeing is that the changeover from where everything was made from China, et cetera, back in the last couple of decades. And now, and plus also the market as well, there's a lot of other emerging economies that are coming out into the world as well. And also not even just that, but also the production, a lot of these companies, global companies, they're seeing risk in China. So therefore, they're actually pulling back a lot of or diversifying their manufacturing base across to other countries as well, like India and also Vietnam, my home country where I was born. So those countries are probably going to be the biggest beneficiaries over the next decade as well.
Fantastic. I agree with you on AI. I bought into the ETF robots, which has a lot of stocks around that space. Now, Terry, how do people get in touch with you? Well, firstly, tell me about your model. Is it a subscription-based, or do you tell me about how Freedom Trader works?
Okay, firstly, I know that for a fact that I'm not for everybody, but however, what we do have, we have a lot of free resources and even a free masterclass. So on our website, there's that free, which I spoke about, the free checklist. So if you've got a share portfolio, just download that free checklist. It's free. There's no cost to it. And literally, they're the 10 numbers that I run through for every company that we are looking at buying or currently own. So if you're looking at buying something that someone gave you a tip on, run through those criteria, because those criteria are quite strict, and that will easily eliminate maybe the idea that you've been given, or in the markets, it will eliminate more than 98 to 99% of all the so-called great stocks out there. Those stocks will be gone. So you just focus on those 1 or 2%. So that's the checklist. And the other thing that I do run is the masterclass as well. So there's a free masterclass to come in, get educated for almost 2 hours. And if you find that what I've shown you actually gels with you, then we can have a chat. But if not, then I might not be the right person as well.
Is that an online masterclass?
Yes, it is. Yeah. But it is live. So I do jump on live. So I've got the farmers one and also the business owners one. So it's quite regular. So jump on and you'll see me live. I'll be teaching. And at the same time, we've also got Q&A at the end, and ask me any question you've got, because I want to help as many people as I can.
Fantastic. What's the website, Terry?
TheFreedomTrader.com. So T-H-E, freedom and trader.com, all one word. And for the checklist, I believe it's just go into that site, because you'll see the checklist pop up actually.
I think I'm going to join a masterclass, Terry.
No problems.
Well, thanks so much for coming on. I've learned heaps. It's been unreal. Thanks again, Terry.
No worries. Yeah, a pleasure being here, and hope that I've been able to,
If you own an investment property, then Washington & Brown can help you pay less tax with an ATO-compliant depreciation schedule. Visit washingtonbrown.com.au to pay less tax today.